Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty gritty.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Gritty Hour. I'm here with Anthony Manera, who has been on in the past. He's an adjunct professor, and he joined us for a previous episode when we dealt with the state of education in America. And welcome back, Anthony. It's good to have you back.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's our pleasure. Anthony is an adjunct professor who teaches macroeconomics at Fordham University. And in addition to that, he teaches securities and investment analysis at Hunter College, correct?
That's correct.
And today we're hopefully going to talk about the evolution of how things get traded on Wall Street, which has changed a lot in the last 23 years, I'd say. So how's things down in Fordham and Hunter?
Things are going pretty well. Very excited about teaching. It seems to be a passion of mine that I'm sort of pivoting towards. And a lot of really bright kids that are in the schools, and they're eager and willing to learn. Some of what I'm teaching has become history, though, because, as you know, things have changed a lot on Wall Street. You and I were of the generation that either trained or worked on the floors of the New York Stock Exchange, the Blue Room, the Garage, you know, all of that.
When I saw you in person last, we would discuss it. I was mentioning to you, on a rare occasion, I would go out on the corner of Nassau and Wall and have a cigarette, you know. And there used to be literally hundreds and hundreds of traders of different variety hanging out outside doing the same thing I was doing. They all had different colored coats for the $2 brokers and the, you know, the floor exchangers and all sorts of stuff. And they've all been pushed by the wayside by automation. And I mentioned to you, and I think this will be the propellant of our conversation today, what pushed them out, for want of a better term, is the conversion of trades being settled in decimals rather than fractions, because most of those fellas and ladies lived off the fractions. Yeah. So those of us old enough to remember, stocks would be quoted in like 5 5/8, 5 1/2, 5 1/4, and they lived off that fraction difference between the bid and the ask. So And that's why I was thinking this would make a good podcast to have you on, as you're an expert in the field, to discuss some of these changes in the last, let's say, the year 2000 on.
Well, I think that a lot of what's happened is due to automation, the ability, actually the globalization of stocks as well, where I think European markets were already on a decimal system well before the United States was. Right. And it became a more perfect market, I guess, or a narrower trading market with a tighter spread, basically due to the fact that, you know, volumes were increasing and the electronics behind the trades started to substitute the manual labor that we all knew about when we were trading on the stock exchange.
Right.
And, you know, the evolution of what happened was, it just became more and more efficient. It just started becoming more high volume, lower margin business. And if I can, I'm going to share a little bit of my screen. Is that okay?
And before you, while you're doing that, I was going to say a lot of the propellant to those changes and the narrowing of the margins, as you say, was the regulatory bodies stressing the advantages to the buyer or the end user. That's appropriate, and that's what brought us to essentially where we are today.
I agree. There was you know, obviously the trading that took place in the old days was much less efficient, but much more lucrative for whoever was in the job. And there was a completely different camaraderie and business feel to it, as you know, having worked on the floor, that came about. It sort of had gallows humor, you know, that was what was rampant in on the floor of the exchanges. That has now been substituted a lot by electronic trading platforms. There's very little or less of the ability to be responsible for trades. They are all sort of push button. If you're even on the floor sometimes dealing with odd lots or whatever it is that they're trading down there these days. This is basically what happened to can you see that now, Tom?
No.
Okay, hang on. Now you should. Okay. So what happened was from 1993 to about 1997, they were trading at an eighth regime. So it would be IBM trading at 100 and an eighth, offered at 100 and a quarter, and in between would be the specialist or the traders that would be executing the trades. And that spread generally allowed for much more profit to the individuals executing the trade.
Well, that's what is called a $2 broker. That's how they made a living.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then we then went to the 16th regime in 97, and that upheld until 2001. So there were little teenies that were being traded, right? It's like a 16th would be like IBM trading at 1 1/16 and then offered at 1 1/8 instead of whatever what would happen. So the spread started to narrow. And then, of course, in January of 2001, we started getting into the decimalization of things. So everything started trading at a penny or more in difference. So the decimalization started and is still what we're currently going through at this point, which has made, you know, we're talking about when my first job in Wall Street was when I was 17, and that was a long time ago. I guess it was about 1977, 1978, around there. And I used to call phones for brokers, and I just remember those days as being magical. I don't think they'll ever be repeated that way, but the brokers that were there had a very disciplined approach about selling stock. The average volume on the stock exchange in those days was 19 million shares. Today we're talking about a billion and a half. You know, it's much different. The number of listings was also
2 minutes from the opening bell.
Yeah. So we're talking about something that is quite different. And it's an evolutionary process, as you know. So the volumes on the New York Stock Exchange in 2002, even up to that date, were about 80% of all volumes. So then you see the decline as the automated trading system started to take place. There's like the New York Stock Exchange ARCA. They bought ARCA or Archipelago, changed the name to ARCA. The British automated trading system, BATS, was there. Direct Edge is there, and the NASDAQ OMX also came into play. And you, as you can see, they all started trading on an up, taking market share away from the New York Stock Exchange, which eventually came to a level of around 20% of
that. Right before that, to underline this illustration, is the exchange was then forced to merge. It used to be a privately held entity. Right. Generally, it was what they called it. You had a seat on the exchange.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many seats there were, a couple of thousand, I guess. And it then merged with, what was it, Archipelago? How do I say it?
Archipelago, yeah.
Archipelago. Well, you're an Italian guy. I'll go with that. Holdings, right? Back in 2006, I think. And Archipelago was an automated system at the time.
Right.
Which is now called, what did you say it was called? ARCA?
ARCA. It's ARCA.
Yeah. So all of it translates into a better price for the buyer, the individual shareholder of any particular stock. But I can, you know, this chart you're showing now is probably the reason why they had to merge. They were forced to merge.
Yeah, well, there's just no question that they needed to buy up the ECNs, or electronic computerized networks.
Right.
So there was a number of reasons. I mean, some of it was also large volumes like dark pools that started to emerge where there was block trading, right? I mean, there was block trading even in the 80s, but it started to become an electronic system. And sometimes it was even done off market, so that the volumes were never really recorded properly on the volumes of the New York Stock Exchange, but about 20 to 30% of all volumes were being matched between buyers and sellers outside of the exchanges doing block trades. So the ECNs were participants. They could buy and sell large blocks of these securities, and they could do it anonymously, right? So that was an important factor also in the overall trading. Of course, the New York Stock Exchange, you know, here we got, I think it was, this is the 2000, if I'm not mistaken, 16 numbers, maybe they're a little old, but it's the 800-pound gorilla in all of the international markets, as you can see. And then you have the NASDAQ, and then Japan, Singapore, Shanghai, I'm sorry, Euronext here, Hong Kong, London, the European countries. And then Deutsche Börse, Germany, and Korea. So you can see that New York was a very significant part of world global trading, actually. Then, you know, there was also regulation that, like you were talking about, that forced a lot of this change that was coming about. And, you know, in the early 2000s, we had those corporate scandals of Enron, WorldCom, Rite Aid, all of these accounting errors that were actually trades that were based on valuations that were incorrect because of lying on the part of CFOs and CEOs. And so Sarbanes-Oxley, you know, was put into play here. They forced changes in actually I don't see that here. They forced changes that to come about that would allow boards to have more independent boards that would allow for more accountability on the part of CFOs that would have to sign off on their actual publication of financials. It wasn't really friendly towards European stock European companies that were looking to trade in America. So the ADR market, for example, because of the reporting requirements, became more stringent. So the regulation had some, it was a double-edged sword. You couldn't get a lot of the companies in Europe to abide by the standards that were required to trade in New York. So they abandoned a movement which in the early 90s was moving towards, or in the late 90s, was moving towards foreign stocks all listing on the New York Stock Exchange. And, it's a combination of, again, the evolution of what's happening now. Also, we can talk about the latency of some of these trades, right? There was some trading that didn't allow, what evolved was not only electronic trading, but speed trading and automated trading.
Day trading.
Yeah. And the latency is the frequency that you can execute with on an electronic system. So it depends on the hertz that you have. And they actually had companies that would move their offices closer to the exchange in order to have a shorter distance in order to get the electronic signals into, hyper trading, like what they would do. Now, they would do this trading for very, very little profit, but at the same time, it was executed in a way that would allow them to bring about, you know, even a couple of pennies on a trade. But right. If you're dealing with billions of dollars, you know, this is pretty significant stuff.
Right.
So the system was all, encompassing, and it did allow for a number of different types of systems to come in. The crash on 87 in 87, if you recall that, in part was attributed to electronic trading, right? It was, what do they call it exactly, Tom? Automated trading? What was it? I can't recall, but it was trading that was basically program trading. That's what they've called it. And, you know, they would have some kind of an algorithm that would detect whether if they were to buy and sell certain types of securities, they could arbitrage a certain amount of risk-free profit out of an arbitrage trade between the two securities, for example. So all of this was taking place. And as AI has developed even more sophisticated since then, there are a lot of black boxes that people have developed that help to, they market these black boxes to mutual funds or to individuals and try to get them to invest in these automated systems that they believe will render some kind of a greater return than what it is. And I think that also accounts for the greater volumes that are on the exchange these days. Before, people used to just buy a stock, put the stock certificate in the safe, not look at it for 20 years. And then all of the volume started to accelerate as automated trading started to become more sophisticated and proprietary trading started to come into account. The Volcker Rule, for example, in 2008, started to limit the proprietary trading allowed out of banks. So all the regulation that's come into play to help legitimize, and usually it comes after a crisis, right? Mm-hmm. In 2004, it was because of the Enron and Rite Aid and WorldCom scandals. And since then, Arthur Andersen was completely blown away. I mean, they just eliminated Arthur Andersen as an accounting firm because of the negligence that it had towards the intercompany sales of these companies that were being registered incorrectly.
Well, that crash you mentioned earlier from the 80s,
yeah,
is what promulgated the fail-safe stop if the market swings.
Oh, yeah, the collars that were put on the markets, right?
Yeah, the stopgap measures. But I forget, I don't remember the particulars. I think it was, if it went down a certain percentage, it would hold for an hour.
Right.
Another exactly. percentage would hold for...
They put collars on the actual trading system so that if there was a significant amount of down volume, say the markets were decreasing more than 10% or whatever, trading would halt for a period of time in order for the panic to cease. And, that they wouldn't continue. Now, did it work? Well, sort of a little bit, but, it would continue on a downtrend once it would continue to run. However, it would start to slow down the downward momentum that was available.
I think if it hit a certain percentage after the first two, I think.
Yeah, 20%, I think.
One was like 3 hours or something, and then it would close for the day.
Yes.
It had a certain percentage. It hasn't occurred yet, thankfully.
let's hope it doesn't.
Yes.
Today the market was down roughly 600 points based on Powell's testimony to Congress. That's another story.
Points, because that was considered a crash, the one in the 80s.
Yeah, but proportionately, the market's
percentage-wise, 32, yeah.
Yeah, it's
but 600 down. Points down was an unheard-of number. Back in 1986 or 87.
87, it was the biggest percentage loss. You're absolutely right. That was the biggest percentage loss. Yeah. And I recall it as being a very scary moment. A lot of people had to be let go because, a lot of these firms had hired aggressively. I was an MBA starting my career at Payne Weber at the time. And, shortly after that, they started letting a lot of the MBAs go. So it was a scary time. Yeah. And in New York in the late 80s, there were very few jobs in finance, as you might recall. I don't know. So my career eventually took me towards the tack of internationalization. I started working for an Italian bank, then Citibank moved me to Rome. So in 89, 90. And so, you know, things happen. People pull themselves up and eventually they find whatever paths they can. You got to be sort of creative, flexible, not afraid of change. And that's been the story of my life in finance. No, but yours.
Well, to one extent or another, everybody's life. But I do recall when I was a very young man, new on Wall Street, the operation side, or better term would be the back office of brokerage houses.
Right.
If you wanted to have an operations, and everybody was self-clearing back then, for the most part, you had to be in New York because that's where the population of people that knew what they were doing operationally lived.
Yeah,
I remember the first one was the Bank of America out in San Francisco started recruiting New Yorkers to move out there. This is the back office side of the Wall Street business, to move out there because they were starting a fully operational brokerage house out there.
Yeah.
And I think that was the tip of the iceberg or the point of the spear, if you'd like. And it was exacerbated in 2001, which I think I spoke to you in person about after 9/11, FINRA, which is the governing body, the main governing body of brokerage houses, came out with a rule that every brokerage house, which at the time was basically centered around, still around the Wall Street area, had to have a secondary emergency location. And I remember my firm at the time had to go to someplace in New Jersey that had like a bank of computers that I'm sure they rented out 58 different times to all the brokerage houses as an emergency backup location. This was after 9/11. So that had a profound effect on brokerage houses and where they're located.
And the costs associated with it, right?
That was an additional cost. They had to lease it. And again, it was just this room with a bank of computers that I'm sure at least 20 other brokerage houses leased the same computers, you know. So I don't know how they would work that if it did come to a cataclysmic event where they had to all share these computers, you know. But again, that's one of the things that has changed on Wall Street. I never saw so many dog walkers. I left Wall Street in 2010, and walking around, you see so many people walking dogs. You knew they weren't in offices anymore. They were coming to apartments.
Yeah. Right now, I'm doing. I have a firm that raises capital for companies all over the world, basically. And you were talking about automation and having to be in a certain place, and you said New York. You know, first of all, you know how we used to call on the phone and everybody would be prospecting on the phone? Nobody answers their phone these days, nothing. It's like, you know, you have to send emails, you have to follow up with emails. If you can, you know, it's fine. And nobody's in an office. They're all working from home.
I don't know how they call that, cold emailing.
you cold email and then, yeah, that's true. You prospect through email. Their phones are not accessible because most people are using their cell phones. I've recently discovered a database that allows you to get people's cell phones. So I've been calling them and people are freaked out that I'm calling them after a follow-up to my email. But I got to try and talk to these people. It's like the way we used to do it was always on the phone. You know, people would talk to you. So now it's a much different buy side. And I just... You know, it's amazing, and you can get harness. There's a plus side to it that you can harness the whole world. So you could talk to people in Asia, in, you know, Europe, in South America, whoever has got the money, and you locate these funds that are just all over that might be specialized in a certain area that you're operating in. I'm happening to concentrate now on electric vehicles and carbon reduction, you know, carbon reduction.
Okay.
EV. And some funds are specialized in that area. So they're not all located in New York. Some are in California. Some are in, you know, Asia.
I would think so, yeah.
Some are in Europe. And so the beauty of the technology today is that you don't have to travel to go meet these people and knock on their door, and you have a broader reach. That's good.
Yeah.
Bad side is, you can't use your you know, the skills of, you know, whatever you've learned in terms of, you know, being a great guy and a, you know, a salesperson and, you know, trying to cajole somebody into the trade or the investment.
Yep.
And so it's just much more cold, analytical.
Your personal charm doesn't come through as
yeah, but you know, and those were all skills that you had to develop, right?
Right. Yeah, over the course of time, sure.
So, you know, the world has changed. And my point is that, you know, there's good and there's bad to it. But you have to continue to adapt because change in this business, change has always been, you know, happening.
Yeah.
I was telling you that I was working at Lehman Brothers when I was dialing phones. And there was magic to this business where I would see brokers coming in, you know, starting young. They had holes in their shirts. They looked sloppy. And I would work on the summers. So I'd come back every summer. And the same guys that were the sloppy, but I mean, I could tell they were talented. Yeah, I just remember this one year. I came back and I followed this guy out the door one day. And, you know, he seemed sharper than he was the year before. He had a green Rolls Royce waiting for him. It was his Rolls Royce.
So somebody picked up his phone. There's something to this business that I've got to learn about.
Yeah.
Somebody picked up his phone calls.
Yeah. And those were the days when the, you know, the commissions were much higher. You know, there was no regulation on trying to pare it down. And, you know, brokers were making, at Lehman, were making four times the market share of any other place on Wall Street. And I happened to work for a guy that was one of the top brokers, his group at least, Marty Shafroff, who was you know, number one on Wall Street for a long time. And just being in that carriage house of Lehman Brothers, these guys would be throwing dollar bills out the windows, you know, just to have fun. That's, you know, the kind of camaraderie that was there and the affluence that was there, and just amazing to see. It was really amazing to watch.
Yeah.
Of course, those types of situations slowly dwindled. Lehman became an international global broker and, you know, followed the fate that it did.
I was going to ask you, Anthony, when you teach an investment analysis at Hunter, do you go deep in the weeds until, like, what do you just show them broadly, like how to read a financial sheet?
You know, it's a very encompassing course, and it has everything. And I try to make it a course where, you know, most kids don't know the difference between a stock and a bond, right? But the book that I use is Bodie Kane and Marcus. It's a traditional, people who are on Wall Street know that book. If they're on, they're asset managers, they've certainly studied out of that textbook. And there is subject matter there that not only teaches you, you know, what a stock and a bond is, how to diversify, you know, a portfolio. You use either asset allocation to diversify, or you could also diversify by stock selection, sector selection. You know, there's a number of different topics that are very, I think it gives you an in-depth look at all of the nuances of, you know, what a mutual fund is. Why would I pay anybody a commission or upfront, you know, upfront fee or back-end load? Which funds would be most likely to give you a greater return? You know, those that have lower annual commissions, right? So, I mean, you look at all the scenarios, then you have to learn how to read a balance sheet, income statement, cash flow statement. We look at options. So we do, puts and calls, and we go through some strategies of straddles, bear bull, bull spreads, bear spreads. And so, you know, there's a lot to it. Now, does everybody understand and absorb everything? Probably not, but they have to go through the exams. We have two midterms and a final, and generally they do pretty well. So I think it's a great course. We also do, you know, like margin. Do you buy on margin? What are margin, initial margin requirements versus, margin requirement, the required margin requirements that are imposed by the banks or the SEC. So, yeah, there's a lot.
I was taking a class when I first took the Series 7 exam, so that's quite a while ago, the teacher saying how margin was the most genius thing ever invented.
It depends on whose part you're talking to.
Well,
it's a broker, yeah, they make a lot of money.
Well, yeah, but even as an investor, I mean...
Yeah, you can do it, but you also, there's a double-edged sword in a way, you know, because if the market goes down, your losses get accelerated as well.
Well, so that's why you buy puts to protect yourself.
Yeah, you can do that, but that's sophisticated. That's starting to get into like the next level of what I teach.
I still remember that guy. He was so enthusiastic about teaching margin, you know, how great it was. And it is. I bought on margin many times, but you can't get burned if you're not careful. That's for
exactly.
sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're also paying that you can get burned and there could be a margin call, as you know, and you would have to pull out more money than what you had already invested, right? So you're not expecting to have reserves set aside in the event of some calamity happening. Yeah. Today would have been a bad day for somebody on margin, right? 600 points down. So,
back in the 80s, that very same crash you were talking about, it's in operations, and we were there till like 1:30 in the morning sending out margin calls. So. A lot of people.
Hello, Mr. Jones.
I think they still use telegrams back then. You know, so not to date myself, but there it is.
But
do you take like a particular stock as an example? Well, before I even ask you that, what is your student? What comprises your students? Are these people looking to get into stock market as an occupation?
Some of them are looking to get into Wall Street or become analysts. Most of them start off as accounting majors. So I have a lot of accounting majors in my field. And, you know, I'd say about 20-30% go into a career in finance. So I've got, you know, some that have either gone to graduate school, like Baruch or some of the others that are city colleges. I tend to, I think we have a major problem on hand with the educational system in our country, as we spoke about on prior programs of yours. I don't believe that the cost of education is something that people can bear on a loan. You know, students are just getting indebted. If you go to a competitive business school, it could be anywhere between, you know, $60,000 to $100,000 a year for 2 years, and you just go to business school, $200,000 in debt, right? That's really tough to have to pay back.
Right.
They boast about starting salaries. I know at Columbia, they're about $160,000 just to start out. But do you keep that job? I mean, a lot of people hire you and somewhere down the road, they'll decide whether we're going to keep you or not. You know, so you might have that $160,000 salary for a year or two after you sweat bullets to get into that job. But, you know, if a downturn comes, you're going to get cut, and they're going to lighten their salary loads. So then you have to go out and look for another job, and it's highly unlikely in a downturn that you're going to find something that's going to pay you that much.
In the same industry, yeah.
Yeah, so I tend to prepare my kids. At least I give them a presentation, and I call in one of the managers from the CFA exam, you know, this Chartered Financial Analyst exam, which costs a couple of $1,000s maybe to get you through the whole program, maybe $3,000. And, you know, there's three levels of exam. It's self-study. But if you're motivated, you can get through. And that degree, and I can tell you, you know, having worked on Wall Street, is just as respected, if not more, than an MBA from a good school. So I try to tell them, you know, you decide what you want to do. Do you want to get $250,000 in debt and have a really great MBA? Or do you want to, you know, spend 3 years of your life self-testing, motivating yourself, getting through the level one, level two, and level three, and coming out with a credential, which is just as good. So I try to make it, because a lot of these kids, like I mentioned to you in the last program, they're first generation Americans, and they're the first ones to study in America. And they're not aware of things like the CFA exam or other programs, or even how to manage the costs of financing it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a major issue. And
is that both for Hunter and Fordham University, the students?
Well, Fordham, I'm teaching a bunch of, it's a core curriculum at Fordham. So I'm teaching macroeconomics, right? And it's generally, it's more for freshmen, sophomores. And in the Hunter program of securities and investment analysis, it's more an upper level elective that they're taking. So I've got juniors and seniors, and they're well on their way as to deciding what to do with their careers. And you know, some of them are going to graduate school. Some of them will be going to, finance courses or some kind of, finance business. It could be, you know, one of the big accounting firms like PwC or some of the others are, you know, Ernst & Young, where they do have also departments that are not doing M&A, but they have M&A services involved with it. So it's not entirely just accounting. They're trying to broaden their scope away from just becoming accountants. And some of them are, at least. And you know, this course will help them to do that, I think. And, you know, I've been teaching it for 6 years now there. And generally I get a lot of interest, mostly like 25 to 40 students decide to sign up for it. And it is something that I believe I wish I had when I was in college. I didn't really have a course that alerted me to the capital markets. And it sort of clicked for me after college. I was an economics major, but we were talking about money supply figures and, you know, different things, the Federal Reserve System, open market operations. But we weren't really talking about, you know, different instruments that you could have, money markets, you know, CDs. You could have fixed income securities like, you know, government bonds, regular bonds, corporate bonds, rating agencies. What does that mean? You know, you throw in the whole bucket, and then you got your equity markets, which, you know, you try to make sense of after many years of evolution. So
I guess another change now that you're describing that is the move for the individual investor, the move away from self monitoring their account with, say, 15, 16 different stocks, maybe mix in a couple of municipal bonds or whatever, to mutual funds, where they're letting a mutual fund company run. They right. Basically pick out the
kind. That's one of the things you have to explain to them. Yeah, you pay somebody to do this for you. If you've got a demanding job, you're not going to want to sweat over every stock you've got going up and down. Right. So you pay somebody to do that, yeah. And you pay them like, you know, 1% fee, Some of them have front-end loads, some of them have back-end loads. And then they've got 12-1B commissions, which are marketing commissions, which you also have to pay. So it's a variety of different things that you alert these people, you know, these students to. And so that when they go into the real world and they look for a job and they're talking to somebody who might start challenging them at a conversation, well, what do you think of this or what do you think of that? Mm-hmm. They might be well-versed in it, so that they will get the job, you know, that that they're looking for.
Do you teach them also the risk analysis aspect based on income, age?
Yes, the profile, know your customer, right? The KYC. So you have to know the profiles of each individual and what they're like. And obviously, if you're an older guy like us, you're not going to be trading options. You're not going to be, you know, taking high flyers.
They're balanced fund guys now, Anthony. But you know, you don't put someone who's 65, 70 years old into the same stock or investment tool that you would a 28 year old.
Exactly. Yeah. Who has their whole lives ahead of them. They can make, right, you know, their earnings.
More risk. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we talk about that. There's a whole section also on behavioral finance, which talks about the psychology behind, you know, how you present things, like different types of methods like framing or mental accounting or perspective analysis on what is actually the method that's used to help you make that decision or help someone else make that decision. That's very important on a sales tactic, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that that's in the book and in the course. And, you know, we also go through the efficient markets hypothesis, right? So you talk about, you know, the random walk theory Kendall's random walk theory, where, you know, his initial data was misinterpreted, and then they realized it was all due to information flow and how that information flow hit the stock market and how, you know, the reaction of the specific securities. And we study, you know, news flow and how the actual upticks happen and how many minutes after it happens. And on the downside, sometimes it takes more time for that reaction to take place. Right. And that's for a variety of different reasons. But yeah, all of that is, you know, part of, you know, it's a lot of information, but it's, you know, even if you've heard it once or twice and you've studied it, you might recall when someone sits on the other side of a table and tries to interview you on a job and he goes, well, what do you think of this? Why would it move that way? You say, well, the information came out on the earnings just yesterday. That's why the stock is up or down. And, you know, they've got to be aware of that kind of stuff.
Right. I just thought of another change since I left Wall Street 2010. I remember when I first started on Wall Street, yeah, settlement date was T plus seven, the trade date seven. And then they went to T plus five, and as I recall, around 2000, around the change of the century, they went to T plus three. Yeah. And now I think it's still T plus one, or maybe it's T plus 10 minutes by now. Who the hell knows?
No, I think it is still T plus one. I think, I mean, I may have lost you somewhere because I only recall T plus two, but you're probably right. At this point, it's probably T plus one. Trade settle right away with the clearing.
Well, it was T plus one when I left Wall Street. It was already T1. So if you traded it today, it had to settle tomorrow. So that's just...
That's how fast money moves.
I was just going to say how lightning fast it does move. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember having to mail a check to the broker. You know?
Well, sure. Yeah.
And your check is in the mail. Yes,
I guess I'll just, I just remembered another change, which is stock certificates. You mentioned it before. There's relatively no such thing as I recall.
There isn't anymore. They're all journalists.
They had what they call the DRS system, where it's directly registered into an account for you. Where it's held, I have no idea. Probably electronically somewhere. So if you bought 100 shares of IBM, you would get a little notification that you own 100 shares of IBM. So if you're a, you know, get the certificate, put it under your pillow guy, you're not going to get it anymore, you know. I remember people used to buy Playboy just to have the picture of the naked lady cartoon on the top there. And the other stock that reminds falls into that category is Boston Celtics, or a public company. I don't know if they still are, but back then you could buy a share of the Boston Celtics and get a physical stock certificate. It was a novelty, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Italy, I lived there for 22 years and I married an Italian, and she always complained that I never got her an engagement ring, right?
Okay.
So I said, honey, you don't need an engagement ring. I've got, I'm sorry about this. I just bought you shares of Bulgari. They just went public, so I gave her the certificate.
Hey, you can wrap it around your
finger. I said, you own the jewelry store.
You can put it on your finger if you like, yeah. But that's the thing. That kind of aspect is fallen by the wayside, you know. And it's the God's honest truth. People would buy stocks because they like the look of the certificate.
Well, you know. Yeah. You're owner in like you said, you know, part owner of the Celtics. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I heard that they're starting to do that now with art. They're getting, you know, masters selling pieces of a Picasso that you can own if you want it, you know?
And NFTs, that's the other thing. Oh, how do you feel about Bitcoin? Let me ask you. Educated.
You know, it's just the question. I've been trying to wrap my head around Bitcoin for years now. And, you know, I think that there's a legitimate technology behind it. You know, the traceability of where it is and how it emanates and the blockchain part of it, I get. But what I don't get is how that could become a currency. And, you know, the volatility that was behind it. Is just out, you know.
Well, there were a lot of tears recently, the people that owned
it. The BBDX, I think it was, that lost $36 billion. Right. The guy got thrown in jail, or he's going to trial now. And it's happening too fast, I think. I'm not saying that it's wrong. You know, maybe it'll become a reserve currency someday. Who knows? But right now, I don't understand it. I don't like investing in things I don't understand, you know? So that's what I tell my class, at least, because, you know, I had a kid talking about, oh, Bitcoin. I go, can you explain to me what Bitcoin is? And he goes, no. And you own Bitcoin.
Obviously, you hit the nail right on the head. I don't want to go so far as to call it a Ponzi scheme, but if they were trying to become a currency, I can't see them becoming a currency until they're backed by, like, the U.S. dollar, the full faith.
Well, you know, no government has backed it. So, I mean, no. If a government decides to give its full faith and credit, then that's fine. But I think the dollar is still the reserve currency right now.
Well, the first country that does do that, it then gets tied into that particular country, you know?
Yeah.
So if it's an American, if it's America, which is not going to happen, I don't think, in my lifetime, that's one thing. But what if it's, you know, Nigeria or something, you know?
Well,
then it becomes the value of whatever the full faith and credit you have in the government of Nigeria. See? So
yeah, I would be shorting it if that were the case.
To resolve that, I don't know how you would back it with anything credible that would make it sustainable.
Well, even the dollar went off the gold standard, right? We once had it collateralized, but it is the currency utilized for a lot of global trade, like oil is traded in dollars. So,
right.
You know, people usually have their foreign currencies go to the dollar before they go to any other currency in exchange. So it goes, you know, Swiss franc, dollar, then euro, you know, or whatever it is. So it becomes a cross reference for.
It forces every country in the world to hold reserves of US dollars.
Right.
And so, I don't know how you would call that. It sort of sets up its own collateral by that, you know.
Yeah.
But it's interesting enough, you know.
Yeah, and a lot of our debt as you know, is, you know, held by foreign investors too. So right. You know, China was one of the largest debt holders of our country. I don't know if it still is or not, but you know.
Well, by virtue of that, they're also one of the largest holders of reserve dollars.
Yeah, they have to be. I mean, if they've got that many assets in dollars, so right. They and you know, what's scary is the threat of a lot of these people on in Congress right now that are, you know, starting to threaten a movement against increasing the debt ceiling, which would allow us for the first time default on our debt obligations, which would be calamity in the international markets.
That would not be a good economic move, no.
It wouldn't be a good move, period. You're right.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I think cooler heads will prevail on that one. But they're using it as political leverage right now. So
yeah, they are, but it's still
I wouldn't read too much into
the
it.
The markets react to that kind of stuff.
Well, though. True. That's exactly right. You're right about that.
Yeah. So, you know, if they make this theater, political theater, Wall Street starts to get jittery. It starts to sell off. You know, there's a lot of hurt that can take place. And
well, I think Wall Street or the financial markets in general would rather have more debt than a default.
Right.
So right. It's a choice between a rock and a hard place, really.
Yeah.
But I wanted to touch on one other thing, and I touched on it before, but I didn't explore it. The young investor.
Yes.
The people of the age of, I'm assuming that students should teach, or, you know, maybe the ones that have just graduated from college or whatever. Are they doing an investment analysis before they invest in things?
Yeah, it's interesting. I have had, I would say maybe in 6 years, people approach me with models that they've developed. Okay, so, and I would say about five people did that. So some of them are very quantitative, and they have run, you know, their Excel sheets, and, you know, they talk about, you know, they actually do spreadsheets that will calculate earnings or do a dividend discount model that they believe can bring them an intrinsic value of what the stock price should be trading at. And that is encouraging. And then you've got, you know, the majority of the class that just, you know, is trying to figure out what is a stock, what is a bond, you know, and it's a different type of situation. And I told them, you know, this course will help you to understand eventually you're going to have a 401k, or hopefully you'll have a 401k, and you're going to want to select either a fund or manage it yourself. And these will allow you, this course will allow you to at least target whether, you know, the difference between a growth, you know, growth fund or an emerging growth fund or, you know, a blue chip fund or, you know, a fixed income fund or a balance fund.
We go with the balance fund.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the age, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Because the reason why I even asked that question is you can buy and sell stocks on your phone just as easily as you would send a text. It's sort of unsettling in that regard.
You know, that's technology. There's no doubt technology has increased the velocity of money. The velocity of M1 is now at about, I think, six times almost. And that's because of the, you know, M1, I'm talking about deposits, like, you know, the things that are most liquid in cash is M1. Then you've got M2, and M2 includes things that are more like time deposits, CDs, that are less liquid, okay? But M1, the velocity is, you know, 5.5 times, which is amazing because it's been enhanced by, you know, the iPhone that you could pay with, or the Zelle account, or the Venmo, all these things that have allowed you to interact. And like you said, your Fidelity account could have an app and you could just buy and sell. I have a Yahoo, you know, that I look at my portfolio here. I do all my trades, though, on a computer. So I try to take my time, but you're right. All of a sudden, people can react to some bogus news story or even a real news story and just tap a button and sell you know, no matter where they are.
Yeah, as you long get as they next have to the guy in the bar that says, you know, XYZ Corp's coming out with a better mousetrap. And next thing you know, you, while you're having a couple of beers, you're buying 5,000 shares of it.
Yeah.
You know, and putting your phone away. It's just kind of scary.
Yeah, it is. That's why you're having a lot of volatility in certain stocks. If you've taken a look, just look at yesterday's stock price of Azul, A-Z-U-L. Azul is the Brazilian airline that people from JetBlue have moved over and started there, you know, some years ago. Stock price was up 40% yesterday, up 20% today.
Right.
It's just like, wow. And what was that due to? And that was because they're renegotiating their leases on their planes, you know? And, you know, they even didn't make as much revenue as what was anticipated. But right. The fact that they had this news, you know.
You mentioned at the beginning of this episode, this podcast, that you are looking at, what was it, electric vehicles?
Yeah, electric. I'm working on nautical propulsion right now. It's basically this company in Italy has taken jet technology. You know how jets compress air and have a greater thrust in jet engines. They've taken aeronautical engineering and they've applied it to nautical. You know, so they've designed jet engines that work in the water now.
Oh, okay.
And it gives you 40% more propulsion than regular propellers, right? And it's more efficient. It's cleaner because this technology runs on electric and it has range extenders. So you could go electric for about 20 miles, 25 miles. And then you can use a range extender, which would recharge the battery as you're going forward while you're moving, but in a more efficient way. So the overall reduction in carbon emissions is about, it could be as much as 70%. And the nautical market, when you're thinking of boats and yachts, yes, that's cool. You can get boats and yachts to do it. But when you think of cargo ships and cruise liners, then you really have, you know, that market is just about as polluting as the airline market.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's a small percentage, it's about 4 or 5% of the total carbon market, you're still in a market that can be, you know, if you can reduce that, that'll help. And also the fact that the ocean absorbs this carbon dioxide and becomes acid is part of the problem of the coral reefs and all the fish that are dying. So it's an important market. And that's what I'm working on right now, trying to fund this company.
Cool. Well, the reason I ask is because one of the things we own is a company trying to develop autonomous electric trucks, driverless trucks. And they seem to be, I guess that was harder technology than they thought. I think in general, autonomous vehicles, the technology behind it and applying it to society is a little bit tougher nut to crack than the optimism that they had on it, say, 6-7 years ago. Anyway, the company I own is on the verge of oblivion, so there's always one
of those in the portfolio.
Yes. If you keep it as only one, then you're way ahead of the game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I do appreciate your time tonight, Anthony. Again, Anthony is the he teaches macroeconomics at Fordham University and securities and investment analysis at Hunter College, both in New York City.
Right. Very happy to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I hope, you know, this gets some listening, you know, from the public. And,
yeah, it was very interesting. I could see your class is probably one that I would actually pay attention to, which, you know, it's a glowing.
We can work something out remotely.
Did you have to teach remotely during COVID?
Yes, I did. That was a real challenge. It really was, but we got through it. I'm glad we, you know, were able to do it. That's for the next chapter.
we'll deal with that down the road. But thank you again for coming on.
I appreciate it, and thanks for inviting me.
Can I call you professor or adjunct professor?
Call me Anthony.
Anthony. Well, thank you so much. We'll see you soon.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Okay.